Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Steve Kirk, and it is just really fun to have a chance to catch up again.
Oh, likewise.
The last time we talked, Bartlow's Dread Machine was just in early access on Steam. There were a few levels that people could play, and the soundtrack hadn't been released yet, but now the game is out. It's on Xbox and Steam, and you just released the soundtrack, so congratulations.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You know, it was really fun to talk this summer. I just had the two tracks that you had sent, and it was a little bit like I'd found a dinosaur bone, and I was trying to imagine what the whole dinosaur was going to look like, and now I've got the whole dinosaur, and it's just, what an achievement, that soundtrack. It's just fantastic.
Oh, man, that's great. I love hearing that. That's really, really great. And, you know, it's an hour and a half of music practically, and I feel like it would be daunting for most to wade through the entire soundtrack. So I certainly appreciate the fact that you listened to it.
Yeah, no, I've just had it on a loop. I've just been driving around listening to it.
And, oh, cool.
And it's super fun to hear it in the game, too. And if there are people who aren't familiar with Bartlow's Dread Machine, the premise is that it's this game that was created in 1907 using 1907 mechanical things. And in the game, you play an agent who has to rescue President Teddy Roosevelt, who's been kidnapped by some terrorists. And the way the game just maintains this convention of being a relic from 1907 is just remarkable. And one of the things that we talked about earlier was how you kept the sound really limited to what would have been available then. So maybe run through again how you decided to, you know, choose the instruments that you did.
Well, sure. Wait, happy to do that. The first point of discussion is, you know, guitar is my main instrument, and electric guitar is my preferred guitar type of instrument. You know, and so we knew that we couldn't use electric guitars. What I did do was I bought a banjo, and I said, well, I want a four string banjo, because I'm just going to tune it like a guitar, and I'm going to do that. And if you look at the old early big band charts and stuff, there is as much of an option for tenor banjo to be the rhythm instrument, because they project really well unamplified, you know, and they were often tuned the same as a guitar would be tuned. So you see these little four string chord symbols, chord diagrams at the top of the music that could either be banjo or tenor guitar, right? And so that worked for me. The aesthetic of that worked for me because of its relevance to the time period, but also because I didn't have time to learn to play something really, really well in an alternate tuning. So that worked great for me. And it was a challenge because it's just it's a similar instrument, but it's very different. And what I discovered, though, is that the banjo really performs what a rock guitar, you know, the rock guitar duties that you would have today in terms of having adding punch and momentum to a track. The banjo worked really, really well because they both have this kind of upper mid-range snarl to them, the electric guitar and the banjo. And I thought, okay, well, the banjo doesn't have as much sustain, but what I really need is to just have it driving things home. And and that ended up being, of all of the different instruments that we tried to replicate from the time period, including music boxes and things like that, the banjo was kind of the thing that whenever it comes up, it's not just the playing, it's the instrument has the connotation of both, you know, something that is haunting and plaintive and also humorous. That's how people think about the banjo when they hear it. Everybody, me, you know, pretty much everybody. And I thought, well, that's great, because that is something that can be instantly identified with and utilized to propel a track forward. Or, you know, I mean, I gave myself a lot of the melodies on the banjo because here I am. I didn't have to pay me any extra money. But also it was really, really fun. it's this old K banjo that sounds really good and plays like crap. And I couldn't rest my arm on the body of the banjo without the neck going out of tune a little bit, because the neck was just kind of almost like a piece of cardboard. It would just it flapped around enough so that you really had to keep any weight off of the instrument while you were playing. It was a very precarious. It's a good thing I was recording at home and not performing any of this live. Right? but it was a nice sounding instrument, and I got it to really work. And the parts about that particular banjo that sound rickety actually, in my opinion, help the tracks.
I think so too. Well, and what's cool is, you know, there are a lot of different directions and different styles you could have chosen to play the banjo in. And what you ended up with is this great sort of, you know, proto Dixieland, almost kind of Stephen Foster-ish type sound for it, which is just perfect.
Yeah. I mean, the way you're describing it is how I was thinking about what the role of the banjo would be. Yes. And so I'm glad that came across to you, because that was the intention.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we talked about last time was I am a total sucker for ragtime. And as soon as I heard that main theme, which sounds like it could have almost been written by Scott Joplin, I was just totally hooked. And what I love about it is it does start like that, but then it just meanders all over the place. So it must have been fun to write. And it's cool how you were able to sneak it into so many different tracks.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. That was the main theme was a really, really fun track. And I remember describing it to you last time, but you hadn't heard it yet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Jeff Koshua is the sax player, the guy that does that like classical saxophone solo mm-hmm. thing in the middle.
Yeah.
To me, that is just like, it's heaven to hear him do that, you know? And it was really, really fun to write. And I forced myself to learn it on guitar. It's really hard.
I bet.
I couldn't get it up to that tempo. Like, I'd have to work on that for maybe a week or two. I don't know if you remember this, but he was coming in, and he's a jazz guy, so he was swinging the eighth notes.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, you can't really do that. You can do it a little bit, maybe around the edges. because this is pre-jazz.
Mm-hmm.
This is ragtime or classical almost.
Sure, yeah. The style of it, the style that you got from all of the players, kind of reminds me of Shostakovich's little jazz suites, because if anything doesn't swing, it's, you know, Soviet jazz. And so,
I haven't heard that stuff. I really need to dig into that. So thanks for the tip.
Oh yeah, it's a really, really different sound. And that's kind of the sound that you got from your musicians reminded me of, because they played it like really straight, like a, you know, 1910 sort of little pit orchestra kind of thing.
Oh, so. Yeah. And that was the whole idea. And, you know, it helps to send people mock-ups before they come in to record, which I did. I sent them MIDI mock-ups of all the pieces along with charts, and was going, I hope you're not too busy. Please listen to this before you do the session. And they did, and it was great because they really understood the mood that I was trying to create, and they just fell into it. I didn't have to coach them a whole lot. I had to coach them a little bit. Most of them were just finding score mistakes and stuff like that. I mean, mainly it was like, wow, these guys, I don't have to tell them what to do. They know what they're doing. Yay.
Yay. Well, it was cool to see Rachel Nesvig credited for violin and viola. And I know her work with the Norwegian Hardanger fiddle. She's performed on some kind of Norse-inspired scores by, I think, Gareth Coker and Neil Akery. And so it's just really nice to hear her perform, too. And so how did you track her down?
Oh, that's great that you're familiar with her work. I mean, when I first was given her name as a possibility, that's the first thing I saw when I YouTubed her was the Norwegian violin thing. And she's so great. And she lives around here, so that helps. You know, most of these sessions were not remote until the pandemic hit. But the trumpet player lives in the Bay Area, so all of the work with him, except for the first session where he flew up here, was done remotely in my friend's studio. But Rachel lives here, and almost everyone else lives here. One of the trombone players towards the end did help me out remotely. He lives in Portland. So
yeah, I was going to ask if the pandemic threw any monkey wrenches into the production or recording or anything like that.
I had to cancel a session with a trombone player because my studio is small and there's no control room, and I thought that was too much possibility of aerosol contaminant. I just wanted to play it safe, and my wife was worried about it, so I had to find another trombonist. So that was the hardest thing to do, was call up this great musician and say, you know, I got to cancel the last session, but he's on a lot of other stuff, so he shouldn't feel too bad about it. I didn't need to do that until the last 2 months of recording sessions. So it wasn't. It sure could have been worse.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've heard stories from other people that I've talked with in the last few months about the radical way they've had to rethink just getting their music recorded and everything. So that doesn't sound too bad at all. One of the things that I didn't know about is how active a role the music plays in the game now. I mean, it almost is like accompanying a silent film.
Oh, tell me about it. I'm glad that worked out.
Yeah.
See, I haven't played the game yet. I want to be able to see some people play the game, because I'm terrible at playing games like that. But yeah.
Well, so what kind of guidance did you get from the developers? Did they say we want a 12-minute cue, because that's how long this level's going to take? Or
yeah, the asset list was pretty straightforward. All the gameplay cues were 6 minutes long, and all the boss battle cues were 4 minutes long. And I stuck to that because I'm going, oh, what do I do now? This has got to be 6 minutes long. So I managed, and it was great because you don't usually get longer form requests when you're writing for video games. And, you know, there was no layering or interactivity as far as the tracks mutating to accommodate gameplay or any of that stuff that everybody talks about now. This was just streaming stuff. And I had descriptions of each gameplay level, and I would take a stab at it. And if it worked, then I would, you know, I'd send him a minute demo of it. And I'm going, is this too modern, or is this too, or is this capturing, you know, is this capturing the sensibility of the, you know, like Mechanical Terror? I actually said, I don't know what to do about this. What should I do? And he said, just make sure it goes thump, 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 thump. The hardest part of writing all of that material was knowing that it did have to have a propulsive beat almost all the time. And, you know, I did my best to make sure that that was not a creating a sense of monotony or redundancy, you know. So I worked really, really hard programming the percussion tracks to make sure that there was enough variation going on with that sort of thing. And towards the end, we discovered that we could actually have a little bit of space in the music where all the instruments would drop out except for a banjo and a tuba or a kick drum or something, right? And that worked okay, as long as the general tempo of it was you're just going to keep things moving, because it's a very active game, as you know, you must have noticed by now.
Yeah, someone described it as one of those bullet hell games, and so yeah, it's just really nonstop. So yeah,
it is. It does from all of the game capture that I've seen, it's pretty relentless.
Yeah, definitely. And what I didn't know last time we talked was how many different locations there are in the game. And the agent who is following the kidnapper of President Roosevelt hops on a train at one point and heads out west. And I just love that track. I love how you really kind of changed the sound of that and gave it like a really subtle but iconic kind of western sound.
Into the West. Yeah. I love doing that stuff. And I've had several opportunities to, pay homage to the spaghetti Western style. And I'm always happy to do it because it's so much fun. And it's such a great genre of film music, I guess you would say. It was really, really fun to do that piece. the different locales really, really helped a lot.
Yeah, I bet it's to keep you from getting bored writing the same music, but also they, you know, just the diversity as you're playing through it too.
Well, it gave me the ideas, the locations and the different artwork gave me an idea about how to make this particular 6 minute cue different than the last 6 minute cue, and towards the end, I felt like I could be even a little bit more symphonic than I was earlier on, and it really worked for the cue Showdown in D.C. I used these orchestra 2D unison things. I decided to use that a little bit more because it happens so much in classical music, and it's very powerful. And at first, I was a little bit timid about doing that. I'm going, well, what if the momentum drops out? And I went, oh, I don't care. We really need this. And Clay was all for it. So, yay.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. good. Yeah. that's always great when it's a real partnership and what you've given to the developer they're happy with it. So.
Well, I told you last time that I did more revisions for this particular game than I am used to doing, but usually I had already done a revision or two before I even submitted, what is it called, proof of concept to Clay, and sometimes he would tell me to maybe either change it. Usually when he said, you might want to change it to sound a little less blah, 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 you would end up starting over. Because I knew there was something about it that was bugging him about the feel of the piece. And I also remember last time I was saying, if it's two Keystone Cops and not enough Snidely Whiplash, then I know that I've kind of erred on the wrong side, the side of wacky or zany as opposed to melodrama, right? And maintaining the melodrama was it was kind of a crucial point that I had to always be thinking about.
Oh, yeah. And there's a great track on the soundtrack where it's a cinematic, but it's the melodrama. And it's like right out of a silent film. It's just so cool. One of the pieces that really struck me about a different kind of sound is At Sea, because it almost sounds like you've got a little bit of Philip Glass's minimalism going on there. I don't know if that's really true. That's kind of what it sounded like to me, but it does sound watery for sure.
It's a very maximal version of minimalism, if it is anything like that. I mean, I'm not really a minimalist at heart. I'm a kind of a maximalist. But I would say that, yes, there's that repeated triplet motif that the piano basically maintains throughout the whole piece. And it does, and the whole idea was for it to sound nautical, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, right?
Yeah.
And I was thinking more Ravel.
Oh, than, sure, yeah.
Than, or Debussy, but absolutely, the Philip Glass thing makes sense also.
Yeah, it struck me because that's what I hear first. But then, yeah, Debussy and Ravel both wrote such great impressions of water. So, of right. course, you'd want to like borrow from them. And so.
That was the ticket, I thought, you know. The ticket to success.
Yeah, definitely, because, right? You know, why reinvent the wheel? And so.
Right, right, right.
you mentioned that most of the tracks, because there's a battle going on in some form or another, have that really driving quality. But right in the middle of the soundtrack, and it's happened to me a few times early on in the game because it's tough, is the game over theme.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's just, I don't know, it's kind of wistful and it's like, yeah, sorry you died. But but it just, it's a nice sort of, we'll catch your breath, we'll start over, it'll be okay. But I've just kind of wondered.
Yeah. That's, well, you I'm really glad that that came across, because the whole point of writing a game over cue to me is to not piss the player off so that they don't come back. It's go, you know, things aren't so bad. I mean, I think I described it as sanguine. The cue is, you know, it's like there's an optimistic element to you're dead. Sorry. But, you know, you can go back and start again.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you want to, because it's just such a charming game. Well, now that we have the whole sweep of the soundtrack and the game, I mean, what were some of the cues that you really had a lot of fun working on?
They were all pretty fun, but I'm telling you, I had when I hit number 16, which is Showdown in DC, I really felt like I had hit my stride. I felt like there was there was a continuity all the way through, but there was a lot of modulations and shifts in the mood, and all of the ensemble parts with the actual musicians came out really nicely. So I was really happy with that one. Thank you. I had fun with all of them, but some of them kind of raked me over the coals. Orm, God of the Rockies, kind of raked me over the coals. It's like, oh man, that one I pulled apart and put back together a couple of times.
Wow, what was it about that one that gave you so much trouble, do you think?
Finding contrasting sections that didn't sound too fragmented from the original theme and stuff like that. It was continuity issues for me. It was like, well, the guitar can do something fancy, but only if it relates to what happened previously. And, you know, I had to mess around with the form a lot, with the form of the piece, to make sure that when things happened that were different, that it wasn't too jarring. A little jarring's fine. But too much is like, well, you know, it just sounds like you ran out of ideas for this piece and started writing another one. And I really wanted to avoid that.
Sure.
Sense. You
yeah.
know.
So even like the traditional ABA form really wouldn't have worked for something like this, right?
It's interesting you should say that, because I did really, you know, when I write in Pro Tools, and then I scribble stuff on manuscript paper and stuff. And you know, when that's all done, I port it out into a notation for musicians. But in Pro Tools, I set up markers. And usually there's an A, there's a B, there's an A. And lots of times they were kind of extended forms like that. But I'm very conscious of form. So I will put markers in the session so that I can go from A to A2. To B, to C, and make sure that the form is really happening the way I want it to happen. And lots of times I would do that. Let's say you have an A, B, A, C, A, B, B, A, coda kind of a thing, right? I mean, it's 6 minutes, you got have to repeat stuff. So when I would have maybe a piano sketch down in the workstation, and then I would copy and paste it to the next A, and I would go, well, what if it was in a different key? We really need to modulate a lot, because I was big into that. So I would put it in a different key and figure out, and then I would insert four measures or something to cultivate a modulation that was going to be convincing and exciting, you know, stuff like that. But I mean, form is always a primary concern when you're doing large pieces like this, and making sure that you are repeating enough stuff. But my thing is to try to not repeat stuff exactly the same way twice. So repeat with variations, repetition with variations was a big, strong technique that I used.
Yeah, and that must have been a really wonderful aspect of that theme, because you can throw it in a minor key or use just a few notes of it and it's still identifiable as the theme. And so it's kind of a unifying thing.
I'm glad that were able to identify themes and stuff, because I thought that maybe the idea that there was theme and variations going on in these pieces was something that maybe I just heard and no one else did. So I'm glad you're hearing it, because it was certainly purposeful, you know. Theme and variation, you know, that's a big deal. And that creates the continuity.
Absolutely. I mean, it works. It's worked for, you know, hundreds of years to start with a theme, and then you just kind of elaborate and stuff. But it's nice, because every time you hear it, it's like, oh yeah, we're back home here for just like a little bit. So
just a little bit.
Yeah.
Just enough to get your footing so that we can trip you again.
Mm-hmm.
Around the next corner. Yeah.
Well, is there anything that you did with this soundtrack that helped you work on soundtracks since then, or skills that you're going to be able to transfer to like another project? The banjo, for instance.
I want to buy a better banjo, but I think I found one. I just need to shell out the bucks. It's not even more than a grand, but that's still a lot of money. I've already noticed, and I haven't done any new, I'm still recovering. I mean, it was a year and a half's worth of work for an hour and a half's worth of music, and I think that is cool. That worked out great. It's very, you know, it's very detailed stuff, and I spent a lot of time making sure that it sounded right when it was done, and mixing it and mastering. But I think that what I'm already discovering is that my insistence about modulating has influenced the way I'm working on new material, and that I'm trying to do that more than I did before, and also because I was exploring the tonal harmonic limitations of the time period, it just kind of allowed me to focus on, you know, harmonic elements that I would not have ordinarily used had I not done that. And I'm finding that that's helping too. It's just, it expands your vocabulary when you challenge yourself to do something like this. So it's a hugely fruitful endeavor in that way.
Yeah, I'll bet. And it's just, I don't know, it must give you a lot of confidence to know that you can tackle something like this. And this complicated, and you know, this turned out okay. I mean, there were some tough parts, but still you got through it. So yeah.
Well, I was lucky to have the time to do it, you know. I mean, I can work fast if I'm pushed to work fast, but I'm really glad I had the time to go, I want to try another version of this before I turn it in.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem like the kind of music that you could just write in 2 days and get it ready to go and shipped over to the developers.
No, some stuff came faster than others, and certainly pieces that are less orchestrated happen faster. For example, I guess, the cinematic cue, the exposition, the one that you talked about, that ended up becoming the Leviathan. That is almost the exact, I imported the piano MIDI part into that new session and then started working on it that way.
Thank you.
yielded a lot. And I wrote the cinematic cue in a day or 2 days, and was able to hand over a sketch pretty quickly.
That's really impressive. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that Leviathan cue, because I can kind of visualize this sea monster kind of, you know, coming up out of the waves and going back down again. And those little scales that you added on top of it, I mean, just they really do that.
It's funny. That sound is from the Abbey Road keyboard sound, and it really is the Strawberry Fields patch on the Mellotron that Lennon used for that song. Except that I found that it can do some just dastardly things, because it has a really, really sharp attack. So you can do really fast sequences of notes and just get away with it, because it's pretty clear to hear. There's no lag or anything. And it was great for that kind of stuff where, you know, let the machines do the heavy lifting, let the musicians express their personalities. That phrase came to me sort of in the middle of production, going, I'm working really hard here. What if I just focus on letting the machines play the insane, impossible to play stuff, and then have the musicians just, you know, play stuff that really has maximum impact for what their skills are, you know?
Yeah, well, I imagine, you know, your sound library is just inside and out, so you can probably find the kind of sound you need pretty quickly. But how much experimentation did you do to get some of these sounds?
That was pre-production. So the idea was, one of the first things I did for Clay, and we talked about this together, it might have even been his idea, it's likely, but we decided that the best thing to do was to put together a sound palette template. In other words, a session with just whatever in there as proof of concept at what was going to work. And, you know, sometimes I'd pick a dulcimer sound or something that sounded too much like maybe a modern instrument. And, you know, but I put together a whole palette. So that way every new piece would have all the same instruments in it. So there's a continuity of sound there. But I wouldn't always necessarily use each instrument. So there's an array of percussion libraries that I did. There's an Abbey Road vintage drum kit that I used for all of the meat and potatoes drum parts, the kick drum, the snare. I found an orchestral snare in the East-West Library that I doubled with the snare part, or sometimes there would be two snare drums, like a percussion ensemble, whatever. But when you double the orchestral snare, I'm getting way too geeky for you, maybe. But when you double the orchestral snare with the Abbey Road drum kit snare, it just was really super crisp, and it had a little bit of room sound in it and stuff, and it gave it a personality that was a little less flat and stuff. So layering things helped a lot. And yeah, and I do, I've had the same sound library for libraries for a long time, and so yeah, I do know them. I've even memorized those dumb key switches and stuff for some of them.
Yeah, well, it probably makes things a lot faster if you can just quickly go to the exact one that you want. And I love all the different piano sounds you got too. There's like a toy piano and then the real piano, and they add a lot of color too.
Oh, thanks. I had to farm out the toy piano because I couldn't find one in my arsenal that I liked. But my friend says, oh, well, I have six different ones, and I'll just render out your MIDI part, and you can just pick the toy piano you want. And you're talking about Mechanical Terror?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That saved that cue.
Wow.
From sounding too modern.
Yeah.
Because what I had picked was a kind of a Celeste sound or something like that, mm-hmm. And the toy piano just really brought home the bacon.
Oh, that is so great. But, boy, you know, it's been so much fun to really finally hear the whole soundtrack, and I'm just wondering if there's anything we haven't gotten around to talking about that you'd like people to know.
Let's see. Oh, from Clayton... just a reminder that the game is now available on Steam and Xbox,
mm-hmm.
both.
Yeah, I played it on Xbox. It runs great, and the visuals are great. And it's been so much fun to catch up and really talk with you about this in depth. So, Steve, thank you so much.
Oh, man, the pleasure is mine. Thank you so much for having me on again.